Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Bee Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicbee.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. It has been 152 years since the United States fought the war between the states, otherwise known as the American Civil War. On today's show, I had the pleasure of welcoming Mr. Thomas Fleming, who recently published A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. Now, it's very interesting how people have certain opinions that they formulated over the years, and also they take into consideration what has been going on in our current time. But when you read this book, you truly are able to step into the shoes of some of the people that were key components for the end of slavery, as well as to just be able to understand what the political environment was, what people were thinking, the fear that had been encouraged, as well as the love that had been shared by so many people who really wanted to see such a great change take place. So I would like to welcome to the show my guest today, Mr. Thomas Fleming, who is a distinguished historian and the author of more than 50 books. He's frequently been a guest on PBS, A&E, and the History Channel, and he's also contributed articles to American Heritage, MHQ, and other magazines. So I would like to welcome to the show Mr. Thomas Fleming. Good afternoon, sir, and welcome to the show.
June, I'm delighted to be with you. I don't think there has been a better meeting of the minds of people, of someone like yourself and me. I think we both think along the same line. We try to get below the surface of things and find out what's really going on. What's the answers to why things happened? This has been my motivation right from the beginning. My first book was on the Battle of Bunker Hill, and that was always portrayed. I mean, I actually did a little survey, went around and said, what do you think of Bunker Hill? Was it a great American victory? And everybody said, sure it was a great American victory. I said, no, it wasn't. It was a terrible American defeat. And that's the sort of thing that I've tried to shake people up with, you know, and I tried to look below the surface of how we almost lost the American Revolution. When I did a book on World War II, I found that there was another disease of the public mind, as I call it, that extended the war for a year and a half and killed millions of people. It was called unconditional surrender, and it was no reason why that got into the game, except people have a tendency to go with their prejudices and passions and let them do their thinking for them. This is what this book tries to do with the Civil War. It tries to show how there were deep antagonisms long before there was an argument over slavery. There were deep antagonisms between people in New England and in the South, and that's what makes the war a tragedy. I don't claim that these antagonisms could have been avoided. They just came out of the past, and they were in the hearts and minds of all these people on both sides, and they grew, you might say, in unexpected ways. History had a way of you might say throwing unexpected surprises at people. And I think this is something that you like to do too, no one was more surprised than I when I started to find some of the reasons why we had the Civil War. Let me take one example, which it's the title for one of the chapters, Thomas Jefferson's Nightmare.
Mm.
And that title just leaped into my head as I read how Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence and hated slavery, nonetheless acquired this morbid fear of a slave revolt, and that made him a friend of slavery, not an enemy, you know. He was a very a complex man, and in this particular case, the Thomas Jefferson's nightmare, he authorized or encouraged the French to invade what we now call Haiti to try to regain control of it, and it was a terrible disaster.
Oh, yeah, especially what the events that followed thereafter.
Yes, yes, and so it ended in a massacre of all the white people on Haiti, and that was Thomas Jefferson's nightmare, which he then passed along. He couldn't help himself. He passed it along to the South all the way through the next 50 years when people discussed why it would be a good idea to rid the South of slavery. And believe me, you've read the book. There were thousands of Southerners who hated slavery, who couldn't figure out how to get rid of it because they had this Thomas Jefferson's nightmare eating away at their souls.
Now, it's very interesting, as a professional, as a historian, as a journalist, as so many things that your career has encompassed, you have really lived through a lot of intense political, if you will, atmospheres.
Oh, have I ever, yes.
Can you share with our audience what your career was like much earlier in life for you and some of the things that you had to do just to keep your philosophy intact as you were putting out these thoughts to your readers?
I started out, there's a talk I give, which has been very popular. I call it Encounters with History. And it's the story of my life. I've encountered history right from the beginning of my life. When I grew up in a very corrupt city called Jersey City, and my father was one of the top people who were involved in the corruption. And I started to think, why is this happening? You know, I was still a fairly young kid. And I realized that there was a philosophy, you might call it, of us against them. The Catholics and the Protestants in New Jersey had created this hatred or animosity between each other, and they translated that into politics. And that's why people like my father and his friends could justify saying, yeah, sure, we're stealing lots of votes and so forth, but the Protestants are doing worse things, and they hate us, and we've got to get power and keep it. And that whole us against them philosophy was one of my first discoveries of why people thought and felt that about politics in this particular way. And then another startling thing was I was doing a book on the year 1776, and I'd done 4 years of research, and I had tons of files on it and so forth, and suddenly a phrase hit me right between the eyes. 1776, year of illusions. And I suddenly saw that both the Americans and the British began fighting that year with illusions about how to win the war. They both had the wrong strategy on winning the war. And only towards almost at the end of the war did George Washington realize that the Americans were fighting the wrong war, the wrong way. And he changed the whole strategy of the war, which the Americans thought they could win it in one big battle. And when they got beaten very badly by the British in the summer of 1776, Washington said, "We will never seek a general action again. Instead, we will protract the war." And 7 years later, we won. And that was the way, but that was how we won. Again, we had to get rid of these false ideas that were turning our minds in the wrong direction and creating an atmosphere of disaster and defeat.
I think the book itself, A Disease in the Public Mind, really encompasses all of the, if you will, symptoms of disease.
No doubt about it. It's the public mind. Well, that's something we might talk about for a minute, June. The public mind was a phrase that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson used. Abraham Lincoln used it. Even as recently as 1956, when Adlai Stevenson, the Democratic governor of Illinois, was running for the presidency, he said, "Those who debauch the public, who corrupt the public mind, are just as evil as those who steal from the public." And so this idea that there was this view of reality, which they called the public mind, it isn't just public opinion. It's deeper than that. It portrays, between political parties, the lies that they tell about each other to make them look bad. That's corrupting the public mind. And so this idea of the public mind is a very powerful thing that I've rediscovered in this book. And moreover, when you add to the fact that there was a disease, this public view of things could be diseased by passions and prejudices against other people within our own country, then we start to see how and why we fought the Civil War.
It's very clever that you were able to piece all these different elements together, in addition to the fact that you had people like William Lloyd Garrison,
yes,
who influenced the public through media. I mean, there's so many parallels between what was going on back then and what is going on today. It's just fabulous that every little thing. And actually, in the chapter that you called "The End of Illusions," you reference the Battle Hymn of the Republic and its counterpart,
yes,
Dixie. Once again, you demonstrate the clever manipulation of music.
Oh, absolutely,
to
lead
people towards a particular belief.
And I have a wonderful story connected to that, June. The hero of this book is Abraham Lincoln, but why he's a hero is because he saw through these diseases of the public mind. He had the answer if both sides could have only listened to him before we got into killing each other. And his idea, Lincoln's idea, was that both sides had these hatreds, and the answer to it was to try to put the hatreds aside and end what seemed to be the argument, which was about slavery. For instance, in the last speech of his life, Abraham Lincoln, a few days before he was assassinated, he gave it from the White House. And it was all about how he was going to try to reconcile the two parts of the country and put the whole country back together again. And somebody, towards the end, said, "Let's have a song." And everybody thought that Lincoln was going to choose the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And he said, "Okay, we'll have a song. One of my favorites is Dixie." And that's absolutely flawed, everybody, this big crowd on the grounds of the White House. But there was a man who was gone through the hatreds, and he was turning them all around and saying, "Hey, we can become Americans again. We can forgive each other." That's the whole thing that Lincoln was preaching. And so when Robert E. Lee surrendered to General Grant at Appomattox, there were people in America who wanted Lee to be taken out and hanged. But Lincoln had told Grant, "We're not going to do that, anything like that. We are going to reconcile everybody." And Grant told Lee, "All you people have to do is surrender and promise not to fight anymore, and you can all go home, and we'll try to become Americans again." And at one point after the surrender ceremony, the Union bands, the Army bands, started playing triumphal music, and Grant sent an instant order out to them to stop. And no cheers, no nothing like that. He said, "The rebels are our countrymen again." I think that when I read those phrases, I first came across it when I did a history of West Point many, many years ago. Tears ran down my cheeks. They really did.
Well, just try to put yourself in the shoes of so many different individuals. And I thought another person who you brilliantly were able to allow the reader to fully engage in the mindset of John Brown. I thought you were just brilliant.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, he is the significant character, one of the most significant characters in our history, and certainly in this book. But he was so, his mind was so diseased. First of all, he had a serious psychological disorder. He was a manic depressive, and he would have these wild feats of maniacal enthusiasm. And then when whatever he was trying to do didn't work out, he'd plunge into these depressions. And he seized on slavery as a cause to defeat it, to seize on trying to defeat slavery. He'd failed at everything else. But he also had this violent streak. He believed that without the emission of blood, there is no forgiveness for sin. That's totally opposed to what the Christian religion teaches. But that was what John Brown believed. And so he triggered this. It did a lot to trigger the war. He went up to Boston, and he got a lot of people who hated the South, and they put up the money for him to buy the guns and so forth and attack this Harper's Ferry Armory. There was 100,000 guns in there, and Brown hoped he could get his hands on those guns and pass them out to slaves and start a race war in the South. He had maps of every southern state, and he had identified the counties where blacks outnumbered whites. He was really ready to massacre tens and tens of thousands of people, and it would have led to the extermination of the black race in America. There's no doubt about it. But there was another figure stepped into the picture, Robert E. Lee, Colonel Robert E. Lee. He was sent to Harper's Ferry, and he stopped John Brown. And then he sent men out to Brown's headquarters, and they found in Brown's correspondence these six letters from these six respectables. Two of them were millionaires, people who had given the man the money to let this maniac loose in the South. That's what they wanted to see. And it was such a sad thing to see how this especially when people in the South said that he realized that these respectable New Englanders had unleashed John Brown on them. They turned to each other and said, they want to make another Santo Domingo of us. And Santo Domingo was the name that they used for Haiti. And that, so this is 54 years after there'd been this, 58 years after there'd been this massacre on Haiti. These people, that was the first thing their minds went to when they heard that these secret six, as they called them, these six backers, had supported John Brown. And that had more to do with starting the Civil War than John Brown himself.
Well, I thought what was also really critical to understanding his personality and just his mental incapacitation, if you will, for, I guess, comprehending what is real and what is just an illusion in his own mind.
Oh, yes. He didn't really. He
really was out there. And the fact that his own son pleaded with him.
Oh, I know.
And he was so dismissive was really startling.
Oh, and then a few years before he attacked Harper's Ferry, he was in Kansas. They were fighting a sort of mini civil war before the big war in Kansas between Southerners and Northerners. And Brown volunteered to join this, and he went down into this river valley, and he found a little settlement of Southerners. They had no weapons. He dragged seven men out of their houses, and he shot them. And then he ordered his sons to hack them up with cavalry swords. He thought this would terrorize the Southerners and maybe they'd retreat, but of course it just inflamed everybody. But that was how he thought. He really had a completely unstable personality in every way you can think of. But he did have, and this is why they wrote John Brown's Body, the great song, he did have this burning desire to free the slaves. But he didn't know how to go about it. And that's why the President of the United States, James Buchanan, when he heard that the South was seceding, he said, "There is nothing that we can do now. It's become a disease in the public mind." And that there, imagine, the President of the United States saw how unreal things had gotten, that he could no longer, he couldn't hope to bring the two sections together in a peaceful way.
Well, it just seems as though his delusions were, in his mind, the only way to go to end slavery, even though he was apparently an ultra-religious individual. And it's just interesting how people will use whatever tools that they can to defend their argument for what they want to do.
There's a wonderful anecdote about a Catholic priest. After Brown was captured, a Catholic priest came to see him, and he asked him why he was doing this, why he wanted to unleash this terrible race war. And he said, the Brown said, "The Bible told me to do it." And this priest, who knew a good deal about the Bible, said, I don't think you've got the Bible. You're right about that. St. Paul told slaves to obey their masters. And there's nothing in the Bible that suggests that slavery is wrong. And Brown, who was lying down on a sort of bed on the floor, sat up and said, "Well, if that's what the Bible said, we ought to burn that too." So this was how totally unstable the guy was.
Now, it's interesting. You also talk about Harriet Beecher Stowe and how her own religious influences really, I guess, conveyed what you consider to be a racist perspective, which is very surprising to people that don't necessarily view her book as something like that, and hail it as something that was, you know, a brilliant book that was necessary, especially during that time, to help people to understand what the life of a slave was like.
Yes.
And I, once again, you pinpoint yet another symptom that demonstrates this disease in the public mind. Could you share with our audience about what her spiritual message, which is often ignored and not embraced, and also what, I guess, led to her to stick to those principles?
June, I think that Harriet Beecher Stowe is one of the most, if you can, people that you have to sort of think, this is a paradox, you know, it's both truths on both sides. Harriet Beecher Stowe did arouse many people to concern about the slaves and so forth, but she also was portrayed the blacks as simple-minded idiots. Uncle Tom, that's an insult. If a black person today, a man, calls another man an Uncle Tom, that means he's one of these guys that'll do anything a white man tells him to do. And this was her idea of Uncle Tom. This was totally wrong about a way to describe thousands of blacks in the South, even during the era of slavery. I call this chapter "The Real Uncle Tom and the Unknown South That he helped create." And I show, I found in my research, that there was a real Uncle Tom, a man named Josiah Henson, and he was anything but a yes man. He when he grew up, he became the overseer of his master's farm, and he took crops to market and he bargained for them at terrific prices. He made more money for his master on this Maryland farm than any other white overseer ever made. And then I go on to show and to tell the readers that this man was not an exception. He wasn't some miracle angel descended from heaven. There were thousands of black men all through the South working as overseers of these of huge farms all over the place, and doing the same thing, getting people to work hard and produce wealth for their masters and to some extent for themselves. But slavery was a rotten system. There's no, you're never going to hear me defend slavery in every way, any way, shape, or form. What I try to show in this chapter is that even in spite of slavery, there were these black men who were doing remarkable things and showing they had the intelligence to do a lot more. And this was something that the people they call the abolitionists, the Northerners who hated the South, they didn't want to accept this idea. They wanted to believe that the South was the poorest section of the country, and the North was so much wealthier. In fact, the South was twice as wealthy as the North. If the South had seceded, they would have been the fourth wealthiest country in the whole world. Of the ten states that were the wealthiest in the country, six of them were Southern states. So, and I insist that we should learn and realize that these black men had a lot to do with creating the success of the of these farms in the South, and that's another reason why we can absolutely rejoice that slavery was finally gotten rid of in the Civil War. But how wonderful it would have been if we could have found a system where this whole thing was accomplished peacefully. Mm. This is what Lincoln wanted to do. He wanted to pay each slave owner a certain amount of money for each slave and gradually free part of the slaves. That's, you know, about a quarter of them in the first 10 years and a quarter in the next 10 years. Lincoln saw that this would reduce to zero minus the fear of a slave uprising. And Lincoln thought that if they would accept this formula, if the South would accept this formula, slavery would disappear completely by 1890, and all of these tens of, you know, the million men that died in the war, all these young men would not have died, and the blacks, I think, would have emerged as with a leg up on being treated respectably, and the people would recognize that the talented ones as they emerged. And so it emphasizes to me what a tragedy the Civil War was. The possibilities, this is something I try to get into in the book, the possibilities of a peaceful solution were there, but we just kept missing them.
I just want to make one more comment about Uncle Tom's Cabin, and
yes.
I thought this was really lovely that you bring up the fact that Uncle Tom had more of a spiritual message, which really was not even embraced. It was just overlooked entirely.
Yes, yes.
Very interesting, because at the time, religion was so influential in everyone's lives back then, and to just completely ignore this man's spiritual message, the fact that he chose to take the higher road and chose to forgive those that inflicted pain and suffering upon his life, upon his family's life, that was really what they should have been doing instead of turning to violence.
Yes, there's no doubt about it. Uncle Tom had a message for everybody. That's undoubtedly true.
Mr. Fleming, I just want to say thank you so much for being on the show today. We are out of time. Could you share with our audience your website and also any other books that you'd like to share with them?
Yes, I think there's a wonderful book that's about to be published as an e-book. It's called, I mentioned it already, it's called 1776 Year of Illusions. And that tells you the inside story of the American Revolution, just as I try to tell the inside story of the Civil War and the disease in the public mind.
Thank you so much. Mr. Fleming, I really hope that you come back. I've really enjoyed having you on the show today.
I would love to come back, June. There's lots more we can talk about.
Thank you. And folks, please pick up a copy of Thomas Fleming's book, A Disease in the Public Mind, A New Understanding of Why We Fought the Civil War. Have a great afternoon, everyone.